Welcome to the Slurry Food Series audiocast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. Today is the first in a series of audiocasts about the war on meat, the ongoing effort to eliminate or significantly reduce animal protein as part of our diet. The Biden administration has announced plans to cut greenhouse emissions by 50 to 52% by 2030. Experts say Americans will have to drastically cut back on meat consumption to reach this goal in order to avoid dangerous climate change. Is this true, or is there actually a way to raise livestock for meat that reduces greenhouse emissions, improves the environment, and increases biodiversity? To answer that question and others about how raising livestock can be done in a way that helps heal both human beings and the planet, our guest today is retired holistic veterinarian Will Winter. Will currently is a consultant on holistic livestock management and also serves as an inspector for the American Grass-Fed Association, setting foot on some 100 farms a year to determine whether the farms are meeting the AGA standards for grass-fed meat. He also consults for 1000 Hills Cattle Company, a firm whose farmers raise grass-fed beef around the U.S. Will has left a great body of work over the last 30 to 40 years in increasing access to healthy food through his work on the production and distribution of grass-fed meat and dairy. So without further ado, Will, welcome to the Slurry Food Series audiocast.
Thanks, Pete. It feels really good to be here.
Okay, so the let's just start out. Give the listeners an idea how difficult it is to be a holistic veterinarian, given the rules of the governing veterinary bodies, I guess, on both the state and national levels.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. You're a lawyer, and you know all this as well as I do, but usually you think of rules to protect people, you know, laws protect people, all of that. And I've come to believe that many of the rules and laws are to protect, let's say, a certain segment of the market or the industry or profession. In my case, it's the veterinary board that regulates what we do. And they have what's called a Standard Practice Act. Your doctor, your dentist, any health professional has a Standard Practice Act. And what it is, a bunch of experts got together and they thought, what's the best treatment for a broken arm or gastritis or any one of thousands of different remedies? So they said, well, here's the ideal thing to do. You have to do it this way. And if you violate that, which I do with acupuncture, herbs, homeopathy, chiropractic, any of these things are not in the Standard Practice Act. There's a little smidgen of acupuncture in it now, so it's slowly working its way in. But it's in the Western way of, you know, a guy comes into the doctor with a martini and a cigarette. Is like, hey, doc, you got them needles. I get my back hurts. Well, right. You know, in traditional Chinese medicine, of course, it's a whole different system. They're 5,000 years ahead of us, you know, with that system. And the needles are just part of it. But if you violate that, that's what's called malpractice. And that's what gets you in trouble. And that's the end of your license. And I hate the word retired, almost worse than I hate the word woke, which is a buzzword now. It's like, ooh, it's just like fingernails on blackboard to me. But I loved it when you said I'm a retired veterinarian, and then you listed about 18 hats that I'm wearing. And it's really true. And that, I think that's what it is when you've done a full service life, as I have with a bricks and mortar full-time practice for several decades. I thought, now I actually get to do what I really like to do, and I'm at the top of my game. Why would I want to play golf, you know, or sit around in a barca lounger watching television? I finally know a few things, you know, that I certainly didn't know when I was a new baby graduate. I was dangerous when I first got out of vet school. I had a syringe of penicillin in this hand and a syringe of steroids in this hand. I can cure the world. And of course it didn't quite work out that way. It just, what they taught us in school, didn't exactly work in the real world. So I got this, title holistic. And when I hung my shingle out in 1980, for my vet practice, I put the word holistic in the title, the Uptown Veterinarian, a holistic practice. Well, all my friends were horrified. They said, oh my God, that people think that's you're a witch doctor or voodoo. You know, and they said, take that word out of the name of your place. I said, no, I really want that to be a filter for who walks in the door. I want them to know that. And we had to say it constantly with disclaimers and things like that. It's like, essentially, like, this is a sushi restaurant. If you don't like raw fish, you know, you better go down to the steakhouse. So we were really trying to help people understand the nature of it. It didn't really work. But now I see holistic in a different way, and I get to do this work with livestock. I was a vegetarian for 23 years, so was my wife. And we were ardent vegetarians after we read Frankie Moore LePay's book, Diet for a Small Planet. And we read that book, and we decided, and it's the same theme that's coming up today, the same theme that comes up over and over. Diet for a Small Planet means you vote with your fork, and what you put in your mouth determines what kind of planet we have. It's agriculture is the number one source of pollution, number one source of environmental degradation, number one source of climate change, all of these things. So I thought, I got to get out there. I got to help people get involved in this, because we've made people obsolete on the farm. You know, we've decimated farm country. You only need one giant tractor and one guy to run it, to run 10,000 acres of corn, wheat, rye, barley, oats. And you know, so people go to the city and they're, now we're making people obsolete in the city. There's nothing for people to do. So we have rising rates of crime, rising rates of drug addiction, rising health problems, because people don't feel useful anymore. So the people I work with on these farms that raise, let's say in my case, grass-fed beef, boy, do they feel useful. They get up, they can't wait to get up in the morning and go out and do it again. And they're just saying, will I ever master this? And I said, no, you won't, because it's an art. That's why doctors call it practicing, or veterinarians, we practice, because we're never there. There is just keeps going further. The more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know. So I have the best job in the world. I get to work with these farmers now that are sustainable. They have a healthy life. And we're actually drawing young kids back to the farm. And there's been a brain drain on the farm. Joel Saladin, the most famous farmer in the world, says that farming now is done by D students. And they're, you know, factory farming, commodity farming is driving around in circles all day on a John Deere and air-conditioned cabin listening to some kind of music. And he said, your bright kids, they go to town. Plus, they don't want to spray their children with pesticides and insecticides, herbicides, all kinds of poisons. And so this is a non-toxic way. And you can visually see with your eyes the earth getting better. And we actually measure it. We're part of the Savory Institute, and we actually measure the soil indices, the forages, and we determine how much carbon sequestration we're doing. And all that carbon that's up in the sky that has never been up there before used to be down in the earth. And when we opened it up with the plow, ripped it open, and started overgrazing, started row crop farming, we let the carbon escape, and it's up in the sky. So I think I mentioned to you, Pete, I won $1 million the other day from this award that was being offered for anybody that could find a solution to carbon sequestration. Well, we've got it. I haven't got the award yet, but they're working on it. It's Richard Branson from Virgin Air and Virgin stuff. But anyway, he offered this $1 million award. I can't wait, really. I'm just going to probably just farm and farm and farm until it's all gone.
Well, that's not my vote. okay, well, yeah, just yeah. Let's go into what the mission and standards of the American Grass-Fed Association are. I mean, you've already touched on it a bit, but if you could elaborate a little more.
Actually, that is really a very good point. I'm so proud to be affiliated with American Grass-Fed Association. And the first word is American. And now the reason I go to the 72 farms that Thousand Hills acquires grass-fed beef from is that we want to have that little bug, a little label on our label of Thousand Hills beef, that it's not cheater beef, that it's a real deal. And we have to have that approved by a third party authorization or certification. So the first word, American, there's a lot of grass-fed beef that comes from Brazil, Argentina, Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania. It's flooding in here, and I don't know what it costs now, but we used to be able to buy it for 34 cents a pound. And these are still grasslands in these areas where they have grass and they know how to use it, and they can make this great beef, but it doesn't help the American farmer. So a big part of my task is to help people make money and live on the farm in our, we have a beautiful country. Why not treat it right? Then the second word, grass-fed, is an elaborate definition of what it is. And that definition is both on the Thousand Hills Cattle Company website of our protocol, what you have to do for us to buy your cattle or for them to buy your cattle. I don't really work for Thousand Hills, but I'm a, what do you call it? I'm the veterinarian, but I'm a independent contractor. That's the word I wanted. So I am independent. I'm not an employee. I don't get benefits, which enables me to be a third party evaluator. So I have to visit every farm every year, and just that alone is 72 different ranches, and it takes a full day, and then a day to get there and a day to get home. So last couple of years, I was on the road 100 nights of the year. So I am healthy. I like travel, and it fits with my plan. But once we've inspected the farm, and believe me, one thing I can tell, if we have a cheater in the herd, they're going to go, because the evidence is everywhere that they're cheating. And we have had to do that. We've had people that sneak some grain in or grain byproducts, and a lot of people, if you go to farmers markets or read the ads, they'll say, oh, grass-fed beef. Well, I'm grass-fed. You probably are too. You probably ate a blade of grass one day, so you're grass-fed. But the 100% grass-fed. Thousand Hills changed their logo, their website, everything to be called Lifetime Grazed. And that's important, because what was happening, we were seeing cattle that were 100% grass-fed on that day, but you go back a couple months and they were at the sale barn. And so lifetime graze means they were born to a grass-fed mommy and a grass-fed bull, and which gives them different milk. It gives them certainly different genetics. And the genetics are a very important part of fighting this global warming misconception that cow methane is causing global warming, which is nothing could be further from the truth, except for one thing. 95-98% of all the cattle are bad because they're raised in a CAFO, a confined animal feeding operation, which means that they're eating our grain, these annual grains that we've been producing. And they actually are a very inefficient digestion. So when we can raise the amount of digestion to above, let's say, 70% of what they're eating, which we do by bovine genetics, cattle genetics, we actually get a more efficient animal that digests. And as you know, if you have indigestion, you'll probably get more gas. You'll probably get more methane production. If you have good digestion, you'll do that. So getting them more efficient makes better milk, makes better meat, and we've reduced the methane production. And you know, Pete, I've said it to you before, I'm gonna probably close by this statement, that there was a time when we had over 10 to 12 million elk in the 40% of America that's grassland, and 50 to 100 million bison. So 10 million elk and deer, all these other things. And before that, I mean, we're only talking the last 10,000 years. After the ice age, you'll hear that a lot, but there was a mile of ice over where I'm sitting right now and where you're sitting right now during the ice age. And of course, all the oceans went down. We had the Bering Straits. We had the land bridge. It was 500 miles wide. And we had elephants, mastodons, woolly mammoths, all of these large ruminant grazing animals. And we sustained that. There was no global warming then. There was no carbon in the sky. The Native Americans harvested between 3 and 5 million bison a year. So it's all this free food. They didn't need any fences. They didn't need any feedlots. They didn't need any inputs whatsoever. And the animals didn't have any fences, so they could migrate. So they go to a salt lick. They go to a mineral lick. And, of course, now there's all these towns called something lick, because it turned out to be a great place to live. The Indians lived near the licks because it was easy hunting. And by the way, Indian that can't shoot a bow and arrow straight is called, you know what they're called?
No.
Vegetarian. Yeah. So anyway, the hunting was good. So the Europeans came in, it's like killed all the Indians, got rid of them. And then here's a great place to live. So we have all these towns now that in those great hunting spots.
Mm-hmm.
So the wild megafauna had never encountered a stone spear. So when the Stone Age people came here, they had these spears and they were extremely efficient. They were like killing machines. So you can imagine a mastodon is about 14 feet at the shoulder, but you get 10 guys out there chucking these beautiful spears into these animals, they could harvest them, and they had all this great meat. The Indians had no... Now, again, I'm mostly talking about our continent because we have one of the greatest grasslands in the world. The Europeans they came here, us white people. We're colonists. We just go in and rape and pillage and take everything good, mine it out, harvest it out. It's all worn out. Okay, well, we'll go colonize somebody else. Kill all the natives. Kill a native species. Bring a bunch of wrong species that don't grow here, that don't belong here, that have no natural enemies that take over, like spotted knapweed and, you know, you can go on and on. If you look behind me over here, over this shoulder, you can see some beautiful lodgepole pines that are dead because of a pine bark beetle that was one of those nasty immigrants that came over here. The locals here are working with a yellow jacket wasp that happen to eat beetles. So they're going to try to find a semi-natural problem. But a lot of the pest eaters that they bring in here are actually maybe cause other problems. So anyway, the Europeans didn't know what to do with this breadbasket we got here. 40% of the United States is like a garden. It has this, you know, we call it a short grass prairie. Well, it's only short on the top. It may be 18 feet down below of root structure. And droughts are just a natural part of nature. They happen all the time, periodically. Wildfires happen all the time, periodically, in certain areas. Flooding down Mississippi Valley is a natural phenomenon. It happens all the time. Only we've accelerated it. My parents lost their, my grandparents lost their farm down in Kansas. They were brought over from Germany as wheat farmers to feed the people for the war. We needed more wheat back then. There's been several great plow ups like that, but they plowed. My grandfather thought he was in Germany, I guess, because he was using a plow like you would use it in Germany. He was plowing like 14 inches deep, and the all the sod and everything was lost. So we lost all the topsoil. So their farm blew away in the Dust Bowl. It's down in Mississippi somewhere, and they were never recuperated. They were never great farmers ever since that. And we've had Dust Bowl after Dust Bowl, droughts blow the soil. There's a 40-acre farm rolling down the Mississippi River every hour, and that's been going on for 100 years because we don't know how to live here. We don't follow what the Native Americans did. We don't listen. We just do everything as Europeans the way we would do it if we were still in Germany or England or Sweden or wherever. And we have to learn how to do this. This is what we teach. We teach people how to raise cattle just like the giant megafauna ruminants did when they're here. So we move them. We never let them take a second bite. They take one bite of every plant, and they munch, 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 and then we move them to a new area. And we might not even come back to that place for a year in the real arid regions. But maybe in 30, 40 days, if we're in Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, where I live, we might come back in 30, 40 days. And plants love that. They love to have a bite taken off. The message goes down the roots. So you secrete a bunch of root exudates, stimulates the plant. Boom, it's back up even bigger than it was. And it's called pulsing when we go back and forth. So we get the creme de la creme right off the top of the plant where all the energy is. And we just keep moving them. So this is the type of grazing that does not cause overgrazing, like West Texas, which is now one of the top five emerging deserts in the world. And when General Sherman marched through that part of Texas in the Civil War, he said, oh my God, there's enough grass here to feed the world. And he was right. They could tie it in a knot over the pommel of the saddle from a mounted cavalry guy.
Okay, we're going to get into this a lot more later, but first, just you're on, you have a better view than yeah, most out there. What's your ground level view of the current state of the production and marketing of grass-fed beef? I mean, what are the bottlenecks? How do you see things going now?
Yeah, thank you, Pete. That is a very good question. And, you know, we think we're really doing well just at that Thousand Hills. Again, this is the figurative we. I feel like I'm a lovely viewpoint. I have the catbird seat to watch it happening from 40 head a week back in 2002 to now 5-6 times that. And the first bottleneck has been finding producers that knew how to do it. Grass-fed beef production is actually something for A students. It's extremely difficult to do. You have to forget everything dad told you sometimes. Or in some cases, dad has to forget everything Sonny Boy learned in his land-grant college education, where they learned how to do mechanistic farming following Henry Ford. Let's turn the farm into a factory. That'll work. Well, of course, it's not working very well. So we have
Karl Marx.
Educate. As far as what we have to do, my daughter's releasing her geese, if you can hear them honking in the background. She has a wild fauna that the geese and chickens pick all the ticks and bugs out of their living area. And they eat hardly any grain. They give them a lot of their scraps. So it's like they're going to have really nice eggs and some meat. So it's really fun to see my daughter and her husband practicing exactly what we're talking about. But the bottleneck was teaching people how to make it. So then we got some grass-fed beef. We got a few head. And we were lucky. We had a processing plant, which is the biggest bottleneck now, is finding a processing plant that isn't contaminated with factory beef. We don't want our beef to touch anything that's been touched by a feedlot animal, because they're loaded with E. coli, salmonella, all the deadly pathogens, and it doesn't grow in grass-fed beef. Grass-fed beef has a different pH, and E. coli, salmonella will not grow there. And so it's really interesting how that works. So we have to find a plant that is our size. We're a little nothing. We're a mosquito compared to JBS and Cargill and ADM and all the giant factory operations. They might kill 3,000 a day in a big plant. We don't want to have anything to do with that. We want an artisanal plant. And our plant takes 12 man hours to go from walking in the gate to a box of frozen beef. 12 man hours. There's a plant down in southern Minnesota. It's a gigantic plant, and it takes them 2 hours per head, 2 man hours per head. And but what happens is that the 2 hour plant, they have immigrants working. They said, okay, Jose, you're going to stand on the line here, and your job is to do this all day. You're going to cut this muscle off. You're going to do this for 8 hours, working at 42 degree temperature and a refrigerator. And that's, well, again, guess what happens to your wrist? Then you get the carpal tunnel, the repetitive task injuries, and that poor guy is out of a job. At the plant we use, which I'm happy to give them a plug, Lawrence Meat and Cannon Falls, they were actually in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He called it the glass abattoir, because they have a glass observation deck that allows you to look on one side. You can watch them on the kill floor, which is fairly dramatic, and you know, but they do it right. These are the highest people at the slaughter plant. They're admired by, they're like gods. They're the guys that can actually do this dangerous work safely and humanely. Then you can look on the other side and you can see the fab room of fabrication, where they take a chilled carcass and cut it into your T-bone steak or your ribeye or your hamburger. So it's a fabulous plant, and they change the station of every worker every 2 weeks, except the kill floor. Those guys rotate, but not everybody works on the kill floor. The kill floor is extremely dangerous. You've got flying hooves, you've got, you know, a 1,500 pound animal that could fall on you, you know, all of that. So those guys are really artists, and we really admire them. Well, then we hit the other bottleneck, Pete. We hit the bottleneck of, we would put grass-fed beef in the supermarket, and we found some very liberal, you might say, supermarkets and co-ops health food stores who would put it on the shelf. And our hamburger was $5 a pound and in 2003 when we opened. And right next to it is identical looking hamburger for $2 a pound. And people thought, are you nuts? Why would we want to pay $5 a pound? We can get the same thing. It was not the same thing. Well, it looks the same. Oh, okay. So then we bought a bunch of little electric grills. And all of us, myself included, put an apron on, a cowboy hat. And we sat in the supermarket with our grill. And we go, hey, would you like to try some 100% grass-fed beef? Well, yes, I would. And people put it in their mouth. And the number one word that they would say, of course, is, wow. And then the second thing they would say is, well, there are two versions of what the second. The first one, if anybody's like our age, they would say, oh, my golly, I remember when beef used to taste like this. And flavors are like smells. They'll bring you back to a different time. I remember when beef had flavor. It didn't taste like ketchup. And then the second thing is say, where is it? And it would jump in the shopping cart. So we kickstarted our own movement by flavor. And it's really interesting. There's a lot of reasons we like grass-fed beef, like, say, no E. coli, no salmonella, listeria, campylobacter, all the deadly poisons. We don't have to deal with that. So you can eat it raw. We have a lot of raw foodists that come in and just buy our hamburger, and they eat it raw, and they don't get sick. Then the second thing is it has the right kind of fat. It doesn't have much omega-6 fat. It's a one-to-one ratio with omega-3 fat. And I know that sounds complicated, but omega-3 is anti-inflammatory. It makes you not be on fire. Omega-6 puts you on fire. So the Americans now, modern diet is like, of the anti-inflammatory, 1 to 15 to 20, all your seed oils are this inflammatory fat. So we need more of this. The paleo diet, the caveman diet, is 1 to 1. And that's the ratio humans evolved to eat. Anti-inflammatory. You need inflammatory sometimes. You break your leg or something, you want some inflammation. Or you have a fever, you want that. But then anti-inflammatory is what we're missing. So you look at any hospital today or any healthcare organizations, people are on fire. Their joints are on fire, can't walk. Their skin is on fire. They got eczema and seborrhea. Their lungs are on fire. They got asthma. They got all kinds of allergy problems. And their guts are on fire. They got inflammatory bowel syndromes. So that's that 20 to 1. That's what that'll do for you. It's a real big deal. And then the environment, you talk to them about, save the planet and enjoy doing it. That was our slogan for a while. Well, people, that's all really great stuff. But the real reason people bought grass-fed beef is it tastes great. It tastes really, really good. And then we hit another bottleneck, Pete, and that was that people don't know how to cook it. And you probably, like me, I grew up, my mother would just cook the bejesus out of everything. If we had a roast beef, it would be like this big slab. And when we ate it, it was this black thing, you know, that was like charcoal. And you're chewing, and it tastes like A1 sauce, basically. So we have to teach people that you can't overcook grass-fed beef. So that's probably more than you wanted to hear about grass-fed beef, but I'm really wound up about it. I save the planet, enjoy doing it. How's that for a slogan?
I think it'll stick. I mean, you've said to me in the past, you just think the sky's the limit for grass-fed beef. So let's take a look at the conventional meat market. What's your current assessment of what's going on there, especially with the last year, the lockdowns and all that?
Oh, yeah. Well, golly, don't get me started about CAFOs. We try to love everybody, you know, equally, especially everybody that's trying to make a living raising food. That's a sacred obligation to raise food. You have people's lives in your hand. Everything we do, we realize somebody could die if it's not top notch. Raw milk is the same way. You and I have been raw milk advocates. If you drank raw milk from a commodity dairy, you'd probably be dead. It'd probably kill you. It's just they have to cook it because pasteurization has allowed people to sell dirty milk. So if we're selling raw milk that we certify, we know that you can drink it and it'll be the healthiest thing you ever did. Well, the same thing is true with CAFO beef. CAFO beef is killing Americans. And, you know, maybe with overpopulation, that's not all bad. but it's killing the planet. And that, I mean, not the planet, our ability to live on the planet. The planet will be absolutely fine once this flea infestation called Homo sapiens is gone. The planet will survive. You're not going to kill the planet, but you will kill the livability on the ocean and on the land if we don't change. So again, you vote with your fork. What you eat is going to really radically change the planet. So commodity beef, feedlot beef, CAFO beef, what happened, it's actually political and economic. We had a Cold War with the Russians, and they had bigger missiles than we did. And you know how guys feel about the missile size. So they had more wheat and corn than we did. So Earl Butz, when I was a kid, was the Secretary of Agriculture. And he said, you boys get out there and rip out those hedgerows. And we were like, fine, we make a buck and a half an hour ripping out hedgerows. That was my job, high school job, you know, did that all summer. So we could plow up to the edge of the road. And we needed more grain, more grain. Well, what happened is the Soviet Union collapsed, and here we are stuck with literal mountains of excess grain. That wasn't even GMO. Now GMO makes more worthless grain, very dangerous industry to have added to the equation. And so everybody's like, what are we going to do with all this corn? This is embarrassing. So we hide it. And the way we hide it, we feed it to the most inefficient animal on the planet, which is a ruminant. They are never designed. It makes them sick. A feedlot diet for a bovine would be like, Pete, you going out and ordering 24 Krispy Kreme donuts and eating them all day long, and then get up in the next morning and you do it again. And you don't get anything else but 24 to 36 Krispy Kreme donuts every single day. And there was a movie called Super Size Me of this guy that ate nothing but McDonald's food every day for, I don't know, several months. And he was a train wreck at the end of that. And that's what these cattle are. And they have to get them out of the feedlot a day before they die, before their liver turns into yogurt. They get them out of the feedlot and they're like, oh, let's eat them now. But it was all about getting rid of this grain. So it takes 15 pounds of grain to feed a feedlot animal to make 1 pound of gain, about that. Whereas the most efficient grain eater on the world is a bird. And some of the modern chickens can almost turn a pound of grain into a pound of chicken. Pigs are close to that. They're like us. They're omnivorous monogastrics. And a pig eats kind of like we do at these all-you-can-eat buffets. And they put on fat and weight. And they'll gain a pound of pig for 3 pounds of grain. But even our grains are the wrong kind. They're all modified grasses, and they're annuals. And an annual is, you might say, a stupid plant. It's an early adopter-type plant, and it will land. It will open up. You know, if you have open ground, nature cannot stand open ground. It has certain weeds that are the early adopter, or the early plants that land on, and that's what all the grains we are that we eat. So they're immature, like our culture. We're a juvenile colonist culture. We're like the kid that gets an allowance and wants more. You know, get me a car, Dad. I need a new cell phone. That's American culture. It's like gimme, gimme, gimme. And so we refuse to look at how it could be done more efficiently. So these plants are the same way. They're a stupid plant that needs to be and you have to bottle feed it NPK fertilizer. You have to water it. It's like this baby plant, and it's very fragile. And then 6 months out of the year, you know, plants are solar collectors. They are, all energy comes from the sun. You probably know that. But whether it's ancient energy that's stored down below in coal and oil and gas, or whether it's modern solar energy, it's solar energy. So if you drive around Iowa and where I live in Minnesota, after about August, it's bare ground. As bare ground until March or April or May the next year. So 6 months out of the year, you're not collecting any solar energy. And so you have to replace that because you've also mined all the topsoil. And so they live almost hydroponically. Our modern soil in America is just like styrofoam. You know, it's like, let's grow some plants on styrofoam. Oh, it needs nitrogen. Let's put that in. It needs potassium. Let's put that in. So these are the wrong kind of grains. And they're not good for anything. And like say, we hide it by making ethanol to put in our gas tank, which is one of the most, any engineer would tell you, they would hurt themselves laughing at the equation of, you know, taking 10 calories to make a calorie of energy.
Right.
What wonder what's wrong with that picture?
Well, because we have this monoculture, conventional agriculture, if you could talk just about the damage corn and soy have done on so many levels as being the centerpieces of our conventional agriculture. I know you've said in the past the Mississippi River would be the color of gin if it wasn't for corn and soy. So if you could talk about the different levels, they just harm everything.
Yeah, and you know, even one other aspect of it is what they call tiling. And since the soil collects excess water, they almost all these corn and bean fields have, they put underground tile that takes the rainwater away. Since the soil has no organic matter, it can't hold the water. So the water goes down to below. So instead of going into the aquifer or staying in the soil, it goes down to the river. And what happens then is some flooding is natural, but we've accelerated the amount of flooding by not having our traps, our reservoirs, of where the water should stay. And we call that effective rainfall versus total rainfall. The most famous farmer now in America might be Gabe Brown out of the Bismarck, North Dakota area. And Gabe has, he was a conventional farmer, went broke two or three times, had hailstorms, had disasters, droughts, floods, not floods. He was in North Dakota. They have 10 or 11 inches of rain a year at most. That's on a good year. And so what happens then, it doesn't come like a little bit every day, like if you're watering your garden. It'll be like toad strangling gully washers, you know. And then the fragile soil that's depleted of everything is just basically fluffy stuff, all runs down into the river. So all the rivers in the Dakotas and Minnesota they look like Starbucks mocha. You know, they've got, you can't even see a fish in it. You can't see anything. Fish can't see anything either. So you get a bit of carp. So anyway, what he's done is he inherited a farm that had about 0.5% of organic matter. Now this beautiful grassland that we have in America, 40% of our country is this beautiful grassland, had 8 to 10% organic matter when we got here. And that is reduced to 1%. So organic matter is carbon. So I wonder where the carbon is. Well, it's up in the sky. Because we've released it, we've let it go. So we don't have any organic matter. When it rains, we get a flood. We've tiled the area, so we've got these hydrology problems. And then the plants are such babies, these monoculture babies. Insects, if you have a polyculture and a polyculture perennial prairie, that say that fast 10 times, has had about 250 species. So if you're a predator insect, you got to fly, you know, way over there to get another plant that you like. Whereas in a monoculture, they just fly 1 inch and they got another plant. So they breed like crazy. It's like suburbs, you know, they have easy pickings in that. So then you got to get out the insecticides, the DDT, things like that. So then with a monocrop, you do not tolerate any weeds. So then you got to get out the herbicides, and you got to make corn and beans that can live with herbicide in their body. That's the GMO Roundup resistant soybeans. And then you got fungal problems. So you spray or you coat the baby seeds with these neonicotinoids, neonics they call them. And these are insecticides and fungicides. The neonics kill insects. I wonder what species a bee is, a honeybee. Oh yeah, they're insects too, aren't they? So all the beneficials go down the tubes. And we have had a problem lately where these people that buy these coated GMO seeds don't necessarily use them all. So they send them back to their dealer, and the dealer concentrates some of these places. They thought, what are we going to do with this? So they said, well, let's run it through the ethanol plant. So these neonics then are then released in doing this. And there's this major exposure because the product from an ethanol plant is called DDGs, dry distiller grain, DDG. And people feed it to cattle. And then people that have deer farms, which are a horrible idea, the deer farms are fed these neonics, and now we have chronic wasting disease, which is a prion disease, like the press calls mad cow or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, or Kuru is another prion disease. It takes all these different forms, but the prions form in the brain when they're exposed to these neonics and glyphosate. Glyphosate is probably the biggest silent killer on the planet right now, and we blow it out of here by the hundreds of thousands of pounds of glyphosate. That's one of the active ingredients in Roundup. And ironically, we have super weeds, and a super weed is a weed that you can't kill. And they've developed a resistant. So Roundup now has three or four other things worse than the glyphosate. And they still have glyphosate. So that's killing everything on the planet. So we're great, you know. Then feedlot animals are closer together than they would be, and they're living in their own excrement, and they're eating the Krispy Kreme donuts. So they get sick. So, let's see, why don't we do this? And my profession, I hate my profession, because you couldn't have CAFOs without veterinarians, right? Because we provide the vaccines and the antibiotics and the chemical wormers, and we throw all these drugs in feedlot animals just so they can stay alive. So then you're eating antibiotics, you're eating hormones. Oh, let's jack them up a little bit with some hormones so they grow faster. So you're eating the hormones, you're eating the chemical insecticidal wormers, you're eating even the vaccine. We don't know what that does. You might be eating a shoulder steak where that animal is vaccinated, and you're like, oh, that bite tastes kind of funny. Maybe that's where all those 7-ways and 8-way vaccines went in. Who knows? Well, I could go on and on about why you don't want to eat factory meat. And I'm here at my daughter and son-in-law's place, and they're learning about, we're cooking together, and it's education. You and I work with the Weston A. Price Foundation, which I highly endorse and recommend everybody be involved with. But Weston A. Price was a holistic dentist that associated diet with your teeth, whether you have cavities, rotten teeth, sideways teeth, crooked teeth, impacted wisdom teeth. And he found if you eat the right things, it you don't have dental problems. You know, you go to Africa, and these people, they didn't know what a toothbrush was. They had a beautiful row of, like, piano keys, you know, those beautiful teeth. And he figured out, well, that's because they have an indigenous diet. Now, he did his work in the 30s when, even here in America, whatever you ate mostly, except maybe coffee or something like that, was grown on your farm. So he could do these studies. He'd go to Ireland, and if you're 25 in Ireland, you have any teeth left, it's a miracle, you know, marry that one. Because they had white sugar and white flour. So he figured that out. But anyway, on his deathbed, apparently he said, you teach. And that was kind of the message that I think why we're doing this show, is helping people understand 99% of America, I'm focused on America as I'm an American, are not scientists. So they'll believe anything. If it's on TV, it's real, you know. So, and who owns TV? Who controls the mainstream media? It's actually corporations. We're an oligarchy. Our government is, we have the best government money can buy.
Right. You know. So what, literally. Yeah, basically what you've said, just all these criticisms of meat as, just being a factor in climate change, just the excessive amount of feed, excessive water use. Let's see, just
erosion,
using up all this land are all things that grass fed beef. Just there's no problem with raising grass fed beef. None of those are factors. It improves, the environment. And those descriptions only apply to conventional raised meat. So I guess if you could talk about just the benefits more of conventional, of grass-fed meat, and just, I guess, start off with an explanation of what carbon sequestration actually does, because this whole debate just talks about the emission of carbon in, into the atmosphere when they're just talking about the conventional operations.
Well, we're about to witness another extinction. There's been at least five massive extinctions of the planet. You know, a meteor the miles across hits the planet, it causes a wave, and it could destroy most living things. That's what happened to dinosaurs. You know, so we've had these massive extinctions, and we're heading to a zone where humans can't live. The glaciers, the ice caps are melting, so the oceans are rising. Don't buy beachfront property right now. So that's just a minor irritation compared to drought and wildfires and flooding. I call it global weirding, where, you know, we go down to eastern Oklahoma, and we buy a lot of beef out of eastern Oklahoma. And when I was a kid living in Kansas, we looked down on the Okies. You know, that was our joke. You know, everybody always has to have somebody to look down on, you know. And it was just red dirt. It was just dry red dirt. And now you walk out there and they don't have enough cattle to eat all the grass. It's taller than your waist. These beautiful warm season, cool season grasses, all the forbs, the some of the brassicas, some of the legumes. It's coming back. So that's, again, a little bit, it's a blessing of global weirding, but everybody else pretty much is suffering. The epic drought that we're in right now, it's not over yet, and it's just going to continue to get worse. A big part of my job lately has been destocking livestock from these dry states. You can't feed your way through it with hay. You got to get somewhere where they need to be. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but it certainly affects that. You mentioned carbon sequestration. One of the biggest problems that makes a halo around the world like a steam chamber is the upper layers of the atmosphere are polluted with carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitric acid, not nitric acid, NO2, nitrous
gas. Nitrous oxide, right?
Nitrous oxide, yeah. These other really nasty gases that are blocking the sunlight, the sunlight comes in but can't get out. The heat can't get out. So this is a fairly the first time ever that our the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is over 400 parts per million, and for humans to survive, it can't go above 350 very long. And we have to get it down there. And our agriculture is really the only thing that's going to do it. You cannot use a straw, you know. Good for you, you know. But it's bigger than that. Again, how we eat, and we have to pay more for food. Again, I'm an American. Americans are addicted to cheap food. They want to buy something for 5 cents, you know, and. You go in the grocery store and the ads are all about price, you know, and cheap food will kill you. For one, you either pay the butcher or the doctor. You know, that's what we always say. You can eat cheap food, bad food, but your body, your health will pay the ultimate price for doing so. So that we need to support these sustainable farmers. And I mentioned earlier the Savory Institute. Thousand Hills got involved with the Savory Institute, which is about a word that we love, the word sustainability. That means you're not going backwards. You're not mining the topsoil. You're not just hauling the fertility away from your land. You're holding it. But in a way, it's kind of like treading water. So the word that we use is regenerativity. And regenerativity means when you die, you're going to leave that whatever land you're taking care of, whether it's a garden or a yard or a pot, you know, or 100,000 acres, you're actually regenerating it and you're getting it back to nature. You're getting it back to where it would be. And we actually have the scientific tools to measure exactly what you're doing. And with the Savory Institute, we go to the farm every year. We take soil samples. We count the plants, the invasive species, let's say, maybe the weeds, how much bare ground there is, how much compaction of the soil there is. We have 14 criteria that we use to determine whether you're regenerating or actually going the other way.
Right. Okay. Yeah. The Savory Institute kind of works hand in hand with what you do, right? They're the leading organization in the world on holistic management of livestock, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say they're right up there. I mean, when they put out their certification emblem that you get, it's called Ecological Outcome Verification. Horrible name, right? But EOV. When you get the EOV status rating, you're on the A team, and it isn't easy. And it in a way, it's a new certification. It kind of punishes people who have been doing this for 30 years because they're already there. What are you going to regenerate if you're already there? But even those people will still show some improvement. What we really like to do is go on a farm that maybe Sonny Boy's taken over from Dad or whatever. They realize that you can't compete in a commodity market. Grass-fed beef is kind of turning into a commodity, but places like Thousand Hills isn't a commodity. Where are you going to get it? There's only one place you can get it. So we're price makers. We're not price takers. We determine what it's worth. And then we have to find people that are willing to pay that. So it's a whole different world if you're not a commodity producer. So we're kind of training people to not be commodity producers. And one of the best things people can do that are they could go out and find a local farmer that is producing really high quality food. Because we actually have beef producers, grass-fed beef producers, and they go, why are you paying us, let's say, $2.50 a pound for it? And you're selling those steaks for 20 some dollars a pound. We go, oh yeah, you sell it. You go, what? You know, and it's kind of funny, right? Because people that live out in the sticks, they live there because they hate people usually, you know, and the last thing you want to do is talk to some guy that's going to, you know, from the city. And so they're go, yeah, I guess you're right. We'll let you sell it. And 40% of the food dollar goes to people like Thousand
Middlemen.
Yeah, right. It's not bad. I mean, the farmer's getting way more than commodity farmers get. They might get 7%, 7 pennies for every dollar of food that sells retail. I think that's average. So we're giving them a lot more than that. And if they allow us to help them get there, let's say somebody's already a farmer. They're raising calves for the feedlot, steers, feeders, and they want to get involved with what we do. We're more than glad to help them get there. And we just say, hey, look, you can get there yourself. There were people doing this before Thousand Hills, before we were out there. But that took them 10, 15 years maybe. And you don't have 10 to 15 years probably. You want to get there next year or in 2 years. And we just recommend what works. I'm as you said, I'm a herd health consultant. Why would I recommend something that doesn't work? And we know, we've kissed a lot of frogs. We know a lot of things that sound good on paper but don't work in the real world. So we'll set people up with an absolute plan that will get them to the desired results sometimes in 1 year. We have a lot of people that are sitting on a gold mine of grazing potential. They just don't know how to use it. And some of those people will actually give them the segment called finishing, which means you take a 700, 800 pound steer and you put the fat on it. Fat is much harder to acquire than frame. Frame, that you can do that on, you know, mediocre grass with mediocre genetics. You can get their frame up there. But then to put the fat on them, you actually have to use a concentrate like grain. Which gets us back to the other thing that we measure in grass. And it's a one-word test. It's called BRIX, B-R-I-X. And the BRIX value of any living plant, you can go in the farmer's market with a BRIX refractometer, which is a little handheld instrument, and put some watermelon juice from this watermelon and from this guy, and one will be blow you out away. It's 25. The other will be 5. Tomatoes. You see a 5 BRIX tomato, they can throw them in a bag, but before you get home, or you know, as soon as you get home, they're just a bag of mush because there's no nutrient density. And with our grasses, it takes an average BRIX of 12 to fatten cattle, and 12 is hard. If I drove from here in Washington State to where you live, Pete, and checked every few miles farms, I'm going to see 3s and 4s because that's the average BRIX of what we've devolved to today, and that's a nothing burger. They can just barely survive on 3 BRIX grass because BRIX is related to the sap strength of the sap. The sap of a plant is like your blood. If I pulled some blood out of you, Pete, and it looked like Kool-Aid, red Kool-Aid, that would be a bad sign, right? I mean, that means you're not very healthy. You're going to need a lot of medicine to stay alive. Well, a three bricks plant is that. It's Kool-Aid blood. And that plant is going to get insects. Insects have little, every insect has two little antennae, and those antennae are looking for food. So mm-hmm. a plant is sending out bad vibes, you might say, that has every living thing has an aura around it, a electrical frequency, and they look for plants that are sick. So when you get your bricks up to 12, you don't have problems. I have, for example, I have grapevines and cherry trees as a hobby. And along about May, when the first leaves come out, I'll put one of the leaves on the bricks refractometer. And if it's below 12, I'm going to have wormy cherries and moldy grapes. So I need to doctor those plants. And I'll usually do it with like compost tea or foliar feeding. Maybe I'll put some lime around the trees and vines to get that bricks up. So by the time they set fruit, I'm going to have these delicious cherries and amazing grapes. And I do that every year. So that's okay. Just one simple test that people can do.
Yeah. Let's go back to some of these criticisms of raising livestock for meat. Just the methane emission, which you touched on earlier in the audio cast, is one of them. Just mainly comes through cow belching, I guess. But really, that's not that harmful to the environment, is it? And even helpful in the case of the grass-fed cattle.
Yeah, you know, there's methane, which is CH3, and then there's CO2, and these are both things that should go up in the sky. Back when we had, let's say, 50 to 100 million buffalo and elk and other types of ruminants wandering around here, we didn't have any problem with that much escaping from the biosphere down here on Earth. And one of the things that CO2 is valuable for, is a plant takes CO2 and water. Plants breathe CO2. They're the opposite of us. We breathe in oxygen and poop out CO2. Plants live on CO2 and they poop out oxygen. So if there were no plants, there would be no living animal form, because we live on oxygen or require oxygen. So what happens is that if we have a living, breathing soil, all the soil livestock, you might call it, all the living things below, and we always try to say as above, so below, we try to have as many pounds of soil livestock, and that's anything from earthworms to amoebas to little bacteria to fungi to protozoa. All these living things are animals, and they poop out CO2. And so right out of the ground, if you get your nose right down on the ground, it's loaded with more CO2, thousands of parts per million, as opposed to just 400 in the sky. But the plants breathe from the bottom of their leaf. So the CO2 coming from the soil microbes goes right into the plant. It's like, I can breathe again. And the chloroplast, the green part of a plant, thing that makes anything green, is a little factory for combining magically, alchemically, CO2 and water to make sugar. And sugar is the building block for all of the phytonutrients that we need to stay healthy. Everybody's heard now of resveratrol and lycopene, lutein, pectins. There's all types of alkaloids and tannins, these medicines that are in every plant. And if you're eating nutrient-dense plants that have all these medicines, then you will be healthy. You will not need vaccine. You will not need antibiotics. You will not need chemical wormers. You will just be getting it all from your food, the nutrient-dense food. And that's what we're going for. So I encourage everybody to get a Brix refractometer. Brix is B-R-I-X. And that is a measurement, a literal measurement of food nutrient density. And it's down in America. If I drove all the way from here where I am in Washington to Florida, where you are, and stopped every few miles, I'm going to see threes and four bricks. And that is a nothing burger. That is, you can barely exist on it. And that is a sick plant. That plant is also going to draw in aphids and leafhoppers and all types of fungal organisms, viruses. It's a sick plant that in God's plan, it wants to get rid of all the weak DNA, the weak genetic material, all the plants that are sick, and put in something healthy if possible. So we have to get our average bricks to fatten cattle up to 12 or better. Mm-hmm. And we want to have, that is nutrient dense grass, and that will fatten cattle. Regular old grass, the worst grass, mediocre grass, will actually frame them up. It'll build their frame, and might not be high quality, but they can get their frame. And most ranchers can do that. So then they sell that animal as a stocker or feeder. It's a 500 to 700, maybe 900 pound animal, to the feedlot, where they have to put the Krispy Kreme donuts into them to get them fat. And they do that with carbohydrates. Grain has starch in it. That's the carb that animals get fat on, or that we get fat on. Sugar is what grass has. And sugar makes that lovely anti-inflammatory omega-3 fat. And starch makes the not-so-beautiful omega-6 fat that is an inflammatory fat. That seed oil, that's why seed oil is not good for us to consume. Humans never ate seed oil until all this mechanized industrial farming. We didn't have that many seeds. So caveman, paleo man, he never got that much omega-6. He got a small amount to that. But yeah, so we want to improve the nutrient density wherever we go. And the way we do that is with the non-selective mob and move grazing that builds the plant's bricks. We can almost double the bricks in 1 year by grazing it properly. We can strengthen the plant that much. And every percent of organic matter that comes back into the soil means we can retain something like 125,000 gallons of water more for every percentage of organic matter. And the organic matter, not only does it hold water, that holds the soil from erosion. And so it's just like all these win. You think, golly, why isn't everybody doing that? And I guess all you can say is follow the money. You know, there's a lot of money is sucked out of the agricultural community into the urban community by industrial mechanized commodity farming.
So. Right. You're touching on it now. One of the other, we'll get into the, following the money in a bit. But one of the other criticisms is from the climate change activists is that the cows hurt the soil by just trampling on the grass. Mm-hmm. And if you could explain this mob grazing a little more and get into that, how it actually benefits the soil.
Yeah. And, again, we tell the farmer, what did God do? What did Mother Nature do? How did that happen? Well, you get your ruminant bison, which is that's where the term mob and move came together. So bison stick together. And the reason they stick together is they're afraid of predators. So they keep their babies in the herd. They're a tight herd. They're all together. But they don't just stand there. They actually walk while they're grazing. And when they go to bed at night, they may be 10 miles from where they woke up in the morning, which means all the poop that might have worm eggs in it is back in South Dakota. They're in Minnesota. Same with fly larvae. Bison hate flies. And one of the main reasons they stampede is to get away from flies. So they get rid of the flies, they get rid of the parasite eggs. They do all that. So that's what we encourage people to do. And the worst thing that can happen in grazing, and this is why overgrazing is equal partner in the destruction of the grassland, is that overgrazing means, let's say you have 100 head of cattle and you put them in 1 acre. You can do that. And maybe 5 acres, whatever. But the point is, they stay in there all year. So what are they going to eat? Well, they're looking for the candy. They're looking for the candy grass. So they're going to find this sweet, delicious grass, and they're going to munch it all. And then there's not too much of that. So let's maybe I'll eat a weed. Oh, boy, the grass is growing back. Let's eat it again. Well, the plant can't stand to be eaten so many times. So they just keep going back to the candy grass. And we want them to be non-selective. We want them to come in and just eat a bite of everything, all of this biodiversity. And that's where they get their plant medicines, by the way, the forbs and herbs. We don't call anything a weed, really. You know, weed is a derogatory term that is a very bad term because there are, in our world, there are no weeds. Now, we don't like the exotics. I mentioned a couple of those exotics that have been imported here that have no natural enemies. That's why God created goats, by the way. Goat doesn't know the meaning of something you can't eat. And we need more goats and more hair sheep and more sheep to balance out. And we have people like Will Harris down at White Oak Pastures in southern Georgia. And he was a cattleman all of his life. His dad had cattle. His grandpa had cattle. They had cattle, cattle, cattle. And that's what you do. And he's an inventive person. White Oak Pastures is one of the most amazing places I've ever visited. And he said, oh, well, yeah, I'm kind of spinning my tires here. I'm getting the same amount of production. And I'm getting weed problems because cattle like to cherry pick. They like to get the certain good stuff. So Will bought he doesn't mess around. He bought 1,000 ewes, which are hair sheep, and he bought 1,000 does, which are goats, meat goats. And and they just follow the cattle. And they don't eat what the cattle eat. The cattle eat the grass, and the goats and sheep eat what we call weeds and brush. So they open up brush to silvopasturing, which is letting the cattle, you take the shade canopy off of a brushy scrub woods, and all of a sudden these seeds pop out of the ground, 500-year-old seeds. It's like conditions are right, they pop out of the ground. You get all these warm season grasses, cool season grasses, legumes pop up where there was nothing. And we can actually return a lot of the woodland into food production areas. It's funny, if you read the book, Charles Mann's book, 1491, which was the year when everything started going to hell, right, when we got here, said the Indians had this continent like a garden. They used control fire, the right kind of fire at the right time of the year. They already had the natural mob and move grazers out there. And they had this, just this bread belt of more food than you could possibly eat. And they had occasional famines. I mean, there's no doubt that it wasn't paradise. You had to work for it. Everything in those days was not cultivated. It was not improved, not domesticated. So, you know, eating an acorn, you got to know how to eat an acorn because it's nasty tasting if you just eat one raw. But they figured out how to make bread out of acorns and all of this. So, you know, there was this bread basket. So we are mimicking that. And this one bite rule, and the way we do it, I don't know if we could do it without electric hot wire fences, because maybe you have a perimeter fence around your whole farm so that your animals don't escape and get on the road. But then we divide that up. So if you, let's say I gave that example of, let's say you had 100 head of animals on 1 acre, not going to take them long to deplete that. So maybe we should use the example of 100 cattle on 100 acres. That's pretty good. That's a 1-to-1 ratio. And most people live in the Midwest that have grassland can raise one animal per year per acre, a 1,000-pound animal or one cow-calf pair per acre. Now you go out west, Wyoming, certainly Arizona, New Mexico, they might need 100 acres per animal or up to, I've seen 250 acres per animal. And by the way, with our techniques, we can double or quadruple what's called your stocking density. So let's say you had 100 animals on 100 acres. The way we would take care of that is we would divide that 100 acres with hot wire, and they were never going to access more than, let's say, 5 acres at a time. And we're watching, and we're waiting until they've taken the tops off of everything. We drop the hot wire, and they're like, yippee! Feeding time. So they, you know, there's no herding, there's no pushing them. They jump into the next 5 acres, and then we put a back fence so they can't get back to that first 5 acres. So then we watch. It's different every day, every year. And when we recognize, this is the art of this, when we recognize they've munched enough, we move into the next, and they eat everything. They just munch it all down, all the different plants, not just the candy grass. So maybe if we divided 100 into 5, that's 20 paddocks. So maybe 20 to 40 to 60 days later, they go back into paddock 1 again, which has loved this top being taken off, stimulated the root ball, created root exudates that stimulate the plant to tiller to shoot out more new green stuff, which is even better than the old stuff. The new stuff is delicious. So they go back in there, they hit it again, and maybe in one summer we can go around three or four times to these paddocks. Now, I there's a guy named Chad Peterson who was farming, ranching in the sand hills of Nebraska, which is like farming on a beach. You know, it's like beach sand. And mm-hmm. the wind alone will just blow the grass out, and there's not much there. But he figured it out. He mimicked the bison. And he has some bison, and he has a different kind of livestock. He has sheep and goats. But what he did is he was the first guy, this is kind of like the Olympics of ranching, he put 1,000,000 pounds of cattle per acre on his Sandhill Ranch, 1,000,000 pounds. They're standing shoulder to shoulder. Looks like, you know, people in a football stadium. They're munching, munching, munching. And he's got thousands of animals and thousands of acres. So then after maybe 2 or 3 hours at that rate, you can only go 2 or 3 hours. It takes a young man that's dedicated. So he moves them on. And in his place, they never come back to that farm again for a year, to that spot. He's got enough paddocks to do 365 days and then times however many times he moves, so several thousand small paddocks, he just keeps doing it. And if you fly over his ranch on the Sandhills, it looks like a golf course. It's just this beautiful green patch in brown. And Gabe Brown is the same way. Fly over his farm near where he is in Bismarck, North Dakota, and it's this green. Everybody else is dried out. They're dry. You go down to Bluffton, Georgia, where Will Harris is, and here's this patch of green. And many others, hundreds of others, are an anomaly. And the local farmers kind of hate this. Farmers are competitive, and they see someone doing good, and they're like, why am I not doing good? So you don't want to blame yourself. So it's, oh, well, you get more rain than I do, you know, or they'll say things like that. Or you inherited that great soil. Joel Salad inherited rocks. Now, he had rocks and weeds when he inherited his farm. And he's built up, he calls it upping the topsoil. He's built up his topsoil. He's taken probably thousands of semi-loads of leaves and wood shavings, manure. So he's actually built a lush Garden of Eden. And I'm sure he can hit that one animal per acre easily, if not more so. He's already there. He's created that. Gabe Brown is the same thing. And Gabe Brown, his book is called Dirt to Soil, which is highly recommend that book if you want a starter book for how to get started. Not that it's easy to do to mimic what he's done. But he uses... he has multi-species of plants and multi-species of animals, and he calls it stacked enterprises. So in his no-till drill, he can raise organic corn like everybody else does in his area, but he will also seed it with cover crops that cover the ground. So when his combine goes over, he leaves the cover crops. So he harvests 200 bushels of corn per acre, beautiful organic corn, and then he puts his cattle in there, and the cattle have another meal on that. And he might run some hogs in there or some chickens after that. So he's stacked enterprises. His soil is never open. It would be hard-pressed to find 1 square foot of dirt that's not covered with plants on an area with 10, 11 inches of rainfall. We've been on his place. In the cornfield, we dig down 3 feet. And there's still moisture. You can make a patty cake out of the soil, and it had not rained for 60 or 70 days, and he still had that much moisture in his soil. It's a beautiful. It makes you want to weep. It's such a beautiful experience.
Right. Well, I mean, you've basically shot down the argument that livestock use too much water. You've shown how just the proper grazing can retain water. I know the criticism that they use too much land, just a lot of this land, like I think you've alluded to, can only be used for grazing anyway, just with the cattle, they're on 100% grass, so the criticism they use too much feed isn't true. I think with the, the pigs and the poultry, a good chunk of their diet can be grass as well, so this farming is there.
We got plenty of land, plenty of rain. We can make plenty of food to feed everybody on the planet and feed them way better than this GMO modified grain crop, which will kill us too. and the feedlot CAFOs. We just have it all upside down. It's a model that is obsolete. It's not going to work, and we're right at the end of the end, the beginning of the end, I should say. So we're going to watch a catastrophe happening on an epic scale. The Dust Bowl, the drought of the Dust Bowl, was a catastrophe, horrible, but we survived it. There was still enough. We hadn't screwed it up so completely in the 30s like we have now. So now we're going to be looking at one of those movies where there's, you know, earthquakes and, you know, these movies where there's calamity. That's going to be our life. We're going to be facing starvation. We're going to be facing no water. We're going to be facing no power. So, you know, it's really hard to be thinking about somebody's raising a kid today or baby, bringing a baby into this planet that we have done everything in our power to mess up. And then we're handing them all these problems. I'm ashamed of my generation that's been part of it. We weren't the originators of catastrophic ranching and farming. But I'm a hopeful person. There is all good news. This is just the bad news. We actually have a solution. Most people are just wringing hands and fear-mongering, and we're saying, no, we have a very easy solution. It works like crazy. We can prove it. We can document it. We can show you. We can take you there and put your boots on the ground, and you can actually witness what we're doing. It's a revolution.
And you were just talking about, hey, how Gabe Brown has integrated his crop and livestock operations successfully. I mean, just people like you have laid out a blueprint of how you can farm and preserve the planet and the environment. And I think, we mentioned following the money earlier. I go to this food safety conference every year, and one of the biggest sponsors is Merck Animal Health. Because about 80%, I think, of the antibiotics today go towards livestock.
Yeah, that's a sad story, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they were supposed to outlaw it, but it didn't work. You know, that they had, you know, colony collapse disorder of feedlots. And so they had to go back to the antibiotics. Now a farmer can just go into the tractor supply or somewhere and buy their own antibiotics and use them willy-nilly. It used to be my profession that abetted it and created the chemical monster that we have. But now the industry itself, just let's just give it directly to the people, let them figure it out. And which is maybe equally bad. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Something like 90% of the antibiotics go towards non-therapeutic use, I think, in livestock right now. So.
It's a huge, huge issue. And then they poop it out, and it goes into the rivers and eventually into the ocean. So we're killing the ocean too. And again, I want to stay positive, especially at the end of our talk. I'm very optimistic. I grew up in the 60s. I was a war protester. We protested three things. We protested the Vietnam War, the racial discrimination, and legalization of pot. And, you know, at least two out of three, we're right. Right. You know, I mean, I'm an advocate of not taking drugs. I'd like to see less restriction there. It would certainly put all the Mexican cartels out of business if drugs were illegal. But we were right about racial discrimination, and we were right about Vietnam. And when the late 70s and 80s came along, we were shocked. You know, we're just hippies. You know, we didn't know we were right. It turned out we're right, but I like a challenge. And boy, I grew up, I graduated from high school in 63, and in 64, the fit hit the shan. And, you know, our world started falling apart. We were clubbed, we were tear gassed, we were incarcerated. And we had a cause, and it really kept us out of our narcissistic little circle and put us in touch with people of different colors, different ethnic groups, put us in touch with why we have so many missiles and, you know, all of that. And, and the drugs put us in touch with music. So,
well, I just think, you know, the economy at some point, I guess, after World War II became based on debt and war, where instead of productive enterprises like agriculture, where the model you've laid out, you can just have these small grass-based operations all over the country.
Absolutely. Thousands of them. We need thousands of them. And we're putting people back on the land. You know, we're giving them a purpose, giving them a non-commodity product that they can actually make a cash income from. Like, if you're a commodity farmer, you need 30,000 acres or something, you know, something ridiculous to make an honest living. We can give people, I have producers that produce on 80 to 100 acres, and they produce, you know, like say some of those can produce one animal per acre, and they micromanage everything perfectly. And boy, you've never been to a happier place. And that's a nice thing about my job. Like I told you before, I have the best job in the world. I'm on these farms and I'm watching these grazing, munching, mellow cattle. You can pet them. You can hug them. You know, they're happy. They're having a great life. They're licking their newborn babies. It's a happy, happy situation. And, you know, and of course we eat them. We call it one bad day, but even at our plants, that isn't even really that bad of a day compared to, a horrible, big slaughterhouse where there's massive terror. And, you know, it's not a pretty place. They won't even let you in, actually.
Yeah, it's a fraction of a day.
Yeah, it's that ugly. So we have this beautiful thing. And we always tell people that are vegetarians that don't think we should be raising cattle. We go, you know what? If we didn't eat them, they wouldn't have existed. They wouldn't have ever got to live. And so we have these, in our case, really happy animals that are humanely treated. They have a delicious diet. And they're fixing our soil and our grasslands so that we can breathe, so we can live, that can fix the climate. Like I said, what's not to get? You know, it's pretty basic.
Well, and I think, like you said, more than anything, what's going to bring the people over to it is that the proof is in the eating. Once that gets out there enough, you're going to see a shift in market share. And I think people like Joel Saladin have said maybe 2 cents on the dollar goes to the local food movement. But I don't think the margins for conventional food are so tight that it wouldn't take more than, you know, another cent or two, I think, to really collapse just a good chunk of the conventional system and get even more people going over to the local system.
I would pop the organic champagne if that happened. And, you know, by the way, people always say, oh, I can't afford grass-fed beef. And that's really another myth that people think they can't afford it. But I've fed thousands of guys steaks. And I know a lot of guys that would go to Ruth Chris or some big steakhouse and eat a 32, 40-ounce steak, big old feedlot steak, and they're still hungry. They desert.
Right.
And I've fed thousands of guys grass-fed steaks. You give a guy a 10 or 12-ounce ribeye or New York strip that's grass-fed, and he's like, oh, boy, I can't eat another bite. I am full. And it's that nutrient-dense. That little bitty steak has that much nutrition in it that they're full. So I think it's cheaper when you look at the bigger picture to buy expensive food. Not only that, you feel good and you are good. Your health is good. So again, it's a myth that organic food is too expensive to have. I don't believe that at all. I encourage people to get rid of their addiction to cheap food. Quit looking at the ads for the cheapest food. Go look for the best food you can get. And go look for the most sustainable food, the most regenerative food, and you'll be happy. And more people can eat that way. And then work with organizations that are helping economies. You know, places I go, I'm in the country, like I said, over 100 days a year, I'm away from home. And what you see is meth labs, and you see people living in poverty, and you see big fat cats that are farming the government. And those people that are raising commodity crops, I tell them, you know, I can tell you how to double your income immediately. Just get two mailboxes, you know. And right. The other joke is that farmers wear those feed caps that have that bill that's curved. And we always say it's curved because they're looking in the mailbox every day for their check from the government, you know.
Right.
Yeah, so we need to have a new farm bill. We need to have a new Secretary of Agriculture. We need a top-down. I don't see that happening. I think it's going to have to be a grassroots movement, no pun intended, where we're actually going to get people to change agriculture by what they choose to eat. That's the only way it's going to work, is just choose good food.
I think there's been a big impetus for that the last year. If you look not only has the conventional food system become more shaky, but the medical system has too. Just with this cheap food, high healthcare paradigm we've been in, that's starting to crumble now too. Just when we had the lockdowns, people weren't able to get in for treatment to the doctor. Now when you go in with the COVID-centric way the medical system is, there's garbage you shouldn't have to put up with that you do right now. So I think people are checking, thinking about more, how can I avoid the medical system? And I think, and I think you agree, the number one answer is just have a great diet. Just eat.
Yeah, and it will actually improve your attitude. I believe the Chinese medicine, I said earlier, acupuncture needles are what people think traditional Chinese medicine is. The number one most powerful thing in Chinese medicine that they change or try to change, you know what it is? Your attitude, your mood. Mm-hmm. If you're depressed or angry all the time, you are going to be a sick person. And then they work on your diet. That's number two. And then comes herbs and acupuncture down the line, and exercise, Qigong and movement exercise. That's really traditional Chinese medicine, is your attitude, your food, and movement. And then for the few stubborn 2% that don't get completely better, then they have Chinese herbs and acupuncture. But it's all a big system. Again, 5,000 years older than us, and it actually has a medical theory. Yin yang, qi, the flow of qi, pain is blocked qi. That we don't have any of those theories. We just try two of these and call me in the morning. So modern medicine is another willy nilly. Let's try this. And we used to use that. Well, that didn't work. Now we're doing this.
Yeah, the example I use is the biggest supermarket in Florida is Publix. It used to be called Publix Supermarket. For maybe the last 10 or 20 years, it's been called Publix Food and Pharmacy. Oh. So the food system is set up to benefit the pharmaceutical industry. So you go into Publix, you buy the junk at one end of the store, and then when you get sick, you go to the other end to treat your symptoms.
We spell pharmacy with an F.
That's right. You have to go back to the... get away from the PH pharmacy and go back to the F pharmacy.
Exactly. Then you don't need the PH part.
Right. The supermarkets are kind of a post-World War II phenomena, I think. So the diet, when you look at the older generations compared to the baby boomers on, the diets were a lot better.
My parents' generation was called the greatest generation. And they were. She lived to be 101. She's a farm girl. She was healthy all of her life. She had almost no medications. But back in the day when I was a kid, all my aunts had huge gardens. My grandmas had huge gardens, maybe half an acre garden. And we spent months putting up fruit and vegetables, canning. We didn't have refrigerators or freezers like we do now, but we did all this canning. And so a huge part of our food came right off of our gardens, right off our land. Neighbors would get you the eggs, or maybe have your own eggs. A guy that's got a few pigs, you get your pork that way. That's the vision I have for how we should live as a city, as a culture. And if you can, go adopt some land and take care of it, or adopt a farm that's somebody's already doing this way, help them. Buying clubs. I'm really a big fan, and I've started several buying clubs where I pick the farmer and, the right guy that has the beef, the right guy with the chickens, the right guy with eggs, the right guy with milk. Because city people might get fooled by kind of a foo-foo farm that's actually a toxic farm, whereas I am a farm, I'm from farm, and I am trained scientifically. I can evaluate the farms, and where you come and buy 50 pounds of pork get your eggs or get your raw milk delivered right to your neighborhood every day. So I hope they're illegal, by the way. I was arrested. This is how I met Pete. Pete was a lawyer that worked for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And I was a member. I was a double member. I still am. I have a membership for my food work, and I have a membership for my veterinary work. And they have pro bono lawyers. If you're doing the right thing, if you're doing the right kind of agriculture, those lawyers, and these are professionals, these are people like Pete that are the equivalent of federal litigators. And usually when the local bozos that are supporting the Department of Ag and the Department of Health Safety and the Department of this, Department of that, they're government employees, and when they see one of these gunslingers come in, they kind of start quivering. And it's really been fun to have a powerful lawyer. And in my scale of life, I'm never going to have a lawyer, you know, that I can afford. But this membership gives you access to some of the top lawyers in America. And I encourage more lawyers to join something like Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And there's many other organizations. That's one I like, because if we don't protect the farmers, they'll wipe us out. And if we don't protect the local food distributor people, they've already wiped me out three times. I've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars where they confiscated all of my food. They shut my building down and arrested me. And wow, this is going on. Pete can tell you stories all day long in almost every state in the United States of farmers that have been arrested and maybe even put in jail next to a meth dealer or a murderer. You know, it's like, this is insanity. You know,
That's another story. I mean, we could do a whole show on your traditional foods warehouse, but just after having seen what the food safety system is like for conventional food, just the farmers you work with, the food they produce, just the what I call local food, it's superior in every way. It's health benefits, better for the environment, better for the local economy, keeps more of the food dollar in, better for food safety. If there is a problem, and there very rarely is, you know, it's much easier to track down where the problem is. It's just
better for the animals too. You know, these dairy cows from these raw milk dairies are like pets. They're like house pets. Right. And they are not overproduced. Usually they're seasonally milked instead of year round. They don't give them hormones, BST. You know, it's like, it's crazy. Some of them even, they only milk once a day because they're grass-fed cows. They go fishing in the afternoon, which is pretty rare for a dairy.
Right. Well, yeah, most of the farmers, I think, with Legal Defense Fund only work milk once a day. But, right.
And, all you right. know, you were talking about pigs and chickens. Those guys, you know, some of the big Tyson and Cargill, they own the pigs or chickens. They own the buildings, they own the feed, and the so-called farmer is basically just a janitor. You know, and they tell him how much profit he makes, you know. So there's a couple of good shows on TV, but one of them is called, I think this series on Netflix now, Rotten. That's the name of it, just that one word, mm-hmm. Rotten. And they have six episodes, and I've seen one on chicken farming. I've seen one, even avocados. It's a cartel, you know, in the place where avocados are grown. So that's a series that I can recommend.
It's a matter of stepping outside the conventional system. It can happen. It's, you know, the regulatory climate is good enough in this country. I see some of the raw milk farmers getting prosecuted in other countries like the British Commonwealth countries, and we've made progress in this country. So,
in addition, you have to be a smart farmer. You can't be a D student. You have to really be smart to do this, and you have to be brave. You have to have a spine. You have to stand up to these podunk authorities that are flashing their badge at you. And I heard this one guy. They had a DEA inspector come out to their farm. They were looking for illegal pot. And the farmer said, "Oh, yeah, okay, you can look around." And he said, "But don't go in that pasture over there. See that pasture? You can't go over there." This guy says, "Look at this badge. You see this badge? This badge allows me to look at anything on your place. And you probably are saying that because you got the pot over there. So I'm going to go over there." So pretty soon he sees this guy running for his life, and there's a giant bull chasing him. And the farmer says, "Showing your badge. Showing me your badge."
Yep. Well, that's right. Well, that's a good way to close. Thanks for taking the time to be on the show today. Hopefully you've convinced the listeners that this drive to reduce livestock consumption is so far off base.
Yeah.
Shouldn't even be considered seriously. To decrease.
Yeah, we can talk them down. I mean, this is an easy argument to win. Easy. There's not even any comparison. There's a book called Defending Beef by Nicolette Nyman. And for people that are on the fence about whether they should eat meat or not, read Defending Beef by Nicolette Nyman. That's a fabulous book, and it will tell you the answers you need to know. And there's another one by Lierre Keith called Vegetarian Myths. She said there's three big myths about vegetarianism as a cult, and which is one is it's more humane, it's not. Better for the environment, it's not. Better for your health, it's not. So she was a vegan, and she wrecked her health. She killed her kidneys, she pancaked her spine. Being a vegan, she wasn't eating right, and she almost died. So she wrote a book about why all right. A lot of education out there. It's stacked to the moon. You know, there's so many good books, videos, educational stuff. The data is out there, and it's bulletproof scientifically, well documented, historically documented. It's out there. You just got to dig a little bit. Yeah, you'll find it.
Yeah, things are going in the right direction. Just need to speed up a bit. But
yeah,
thanks for your time. If you could hang on for just a sec, but great to have you on.
Okay, great. Thanks, Pete. Thanks, everybody.